one thing I was, you know, we had to talk to my wife is like, well, you know, we lost maybe, you know, a large portion of income at this time. And we've got to make sure that we have the cash to fund our life as we're transitioning here. So there's some situations you can find yourself in that are a little bit scary, but
yeah,
those are the risks essentially.
Welcome to Finance for Physicians, the show where we help physicians like you use money as a tool to live a great life. I'm your host, Daniel Wren, and I've spent the last decade advising physicians on their personal finances with the mission to help them understand that taking control of their finances now means creating a future where they can practice medicine where, when, and how long they want to.
Brad, how's it going, buddy?
Hi, nice to meet you, Daniel.
Yeah, good to meet you too. I'm excited for our conversation. We've kind of started catching up before we hit record, but Brad's got a little bit of a, we'll just call it like a non-traditional career track in radiology, correct? Is that your specialty?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So I'm looking forward to kind of understanding more about how you went about it. How many years out of training are you?
This point, two.
So not many years out of training, which is even more impressive and
pretty uncommon, yeah, to have broken away at this point.
Yeah. So we're going to talk through that. We're going to go through kind of his progression from training and then starting in a little bit more of a traditional role and then transitioning into the current setup that he's in now. So I think it'll be valuable for you guys, especially, you know, radiology, but really in any specialty. I think non-traditional path is potentially a solution to a lot of the problems that exist in medicine today. So we'll go through all that today. So first of all, thanks for joining me, Brad. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm happy to share any bits of wisdom I can provide. Hopefully it can be useful for your listeners.
Yeah, definitely. So maybe we could start with just like a brief background of, I've already kind of thrown out some of the tidbits, but just kind of give us a little bit of a brief background to
sure
how you gotten to where you are today.
Sure. I actually have a bit of a non-traditional path before medicine. So I was an engineer and initially, and then spent some time in finance. And then to top it all off, I didn't really have any direction. And eventually I was like, you know, medicine seems like a great place to be. So, okay. So I matriculated to med school in, I think, 2013, 2014. I went to Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. I met my wife there. We matched at Johns Hopkins, where I did my radiology residency, and then went to University of Pennsylvania for a one-year neuro fellowship. So I'm neuroradiology subspecialty trained. All of that, the tail end of my training was occurring through the pandemic. So I think I was an R2 at the time, so PGY3. When 2020 hit, you know, the world sort of changed dramatically overnight. I, you know, ironically, not very much for me in radiology. We're kind of, you know, sitting in the basement of the hospital institution, doing all of our work. But one thing that dramatically changed was, you know, the ability to be a teleradiologist was sort of kind of always seen as like an alternative thing that, you know, was maybe looked down upon in the career. It was interestingly accessible for about 20 years prior to that. It was possible to be a teleradiologist, but you know, it wasn't really a standard pathway. But when 2020 hit, it didn't take me long to figure out, you know, I prefer the diagnostic end of radiology. And I'm not really keen on doing procedures. So, you know, moving forward with a full work from home environment was, you know, was one of my goals. And I, you know, my wife was able to support that as well. So when finishing up my training, I looked for a primary, you know, teleradiology role, mostly neuro, you know, probably 80% neuro to keep some of the general skills in my skill set. And, you know, with the goal of my family and I would probably move to the further up to the Northeast. And we live in New Hampshire in the mountains now. But at the time I had signed with a practice in Texas. So upon finishing my training in 2023, I started with a practice in Texas and worked fully remote for them for the upcoming year.
So you've had a, I guess you could say, above average number of career paths for standard positions. So is this it? I mean, like, what makes this it? Like, is this the right direction so far? And I'm just curious, like, what about medicine has been the thing that's really turned you on?
That's stuck. Yeah. I mean, I actually loved engineering, but for just the reasons that I flipped careers so early on was maybe just a lack of direction and poor decision making. You know, I wanted to follow some of my friends out into investment banking because they were making so much money right out of college compared to like the engineering job I was likely to get. Couldn't really see past that. So I also graduated in undergrad at 2008. And I think I had secured a financial job. 2 months later, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers failed. So that was the start of my financial career, which I spent about 3 years in and did two levels of a CFA. And So I spent some time there working hard.
Did you finish number two?
I did. I think that's the
hardest one, right?
And then I was like, I can't do this anymore. So that's when I started looking elsewhere. I was like, you know what? This is not for me. It was hard. It was, spent another 6 months living in a hole, right? So I sort of went back to basics and thought, you know, what do I love? I always loved the science and aspect of engineering. And I was looking for more of a calling at that time. This is probably 2010 at this time. And a number of my friends had gone into medicine and had been very happy, despite actually some of them were residents. So, you know, I sort of had a lofty view of what it would like to be a physician. And after, you know, working with a life coach and thinking for the better part of a year, I kind of made the jump and committed to it. So, and I think it's been a fantastic decision. I mean, I love my career. I feel deeply rooted and connected to medicine and radiology in particular. I'm sort of a tech person. I kind of grew up gaming and, you know, radiology is sort of like that in real life. So it has a lot of natural qualities that I gravitate to, including the people too. So, you know, you meet a lot of people who have similar interests and stuff in the field. So I think it's in terms of my, you know, my education will largely be, you know, I am a physician at core now and a radiologist, and I don't think I'm going to be making any dramatic career changes other than maybe another entrepreneurial pursuit here or there.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting that it said you worked with a life coach. I'm curious, was there some good like purpose, values, focused conversations that were had with that person? That, how did that play into it?
Yeah. I mean, at the time, thinking back, this is probably 2010, very unhappy in my career and in finance. And I'm like, this is not the setting for me. I think I need to make a major change, you know, and we sort of did our best to strip all that away. You know, what was I chasing for the last few years and what actually matters to me? And those things had diverged quite a bit. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting. You know, this is a side note, but the financial industry sort of has a pull too. You know, it's like the bosses above me at the time were saying, you know, if you stay here, you'll be a millionaire in a couple years, you know, but you'll be a physician and you'll be indebted, which is true. But I am very happy, very, very, very happy with what I do. So in all accounts, I think that was the right decision.
Yeah, I think a lot of the average people in the culture think physicians get into it for money, which that's not been my experience with working with a lot of physicians. Most of them that I know didn't really do it for the money.
Yeah, sure.
It was more of a calling. And, you know, there is a big long track and then debt and all the things on the front end that average person doesn't actually realize that part too. They're like, oh, I didn't realize you have to go through training and all this education and delay and you don't actually get paid very well until all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a decade or more. And, you know, if you're taking out student loans, which I did, they grow during residency when you cannot pay them down. I mean, there's some really significant financial impact here that, you know, might take 10, 20 or 30 years to really come to fruition and pay off. Yeah. I mean, and a lot of people that I've met and been very impressed with are really do care about other people and they care about the career and doing what's right. And very rarely have I seen, you know, people come into medicine for financial reasons purely. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty good. It's pretty well known. I think it's probably not the best field for that. Right. There are others who can make more money.
But. Yeah. So you were mentioning the, this is something I talk about all the time. The thing about like I think you described it as chasing something versus what was actually most important. And so, you know, I would say like your action or chasing something versus your values. And when those deviate, like when you're, what you're doing isn't aligned with what you're, you consider most important, it's like guaranteed disaster zone. You know, you're going to be, you're going to be unhappy. And so it sounds like you were, but a lot of people don't, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people aren't even aware when that's happening exactly. And you're in like the grind, especially when you're in the grind, you're like just cranking it out and you're like doing the things and making the money and doing all the things people say you should be doing. And you're like, but why am I so unhappy? Well, a lot of times it goes back to this, and you were able to get, gain awareness of it. And so that's super awesome. I'm curious though, going back to like your more recent career transition, did you use a similar framework when you transitioned from like the traditional practice you were just starting to describe into your now current new, more entrepreneurial setup?
Yeah, I'll answer that question in one moment. I had a thought with what you were saying, which is people don't often notice that the divergence of what they would like to be doing and what they're actually doing when it's happening. And I think there's a fundamental problem in medical training, which is each next level is opaque at the time that you're in the level below. So it's like you're in undergrad looking to go to med school and you really have no idea what med school is like and the requirements and the commitment that it takes to get there. And, you know, in med school, you might have 6 months to a year to decide on your specialty that impacts the rest of your life. And oftentimes it's hard to get a sense for what is it actually like to be a surgeon, an OBGYN, you know, radiologist or pathologist. I mean, it sometimes is colored very differently depending on just maybe the person you've worked with in that space. You know, it's like you've had someone who's a resident who's been really wonderful or really poor to you, and that changes your opinion. So in that regard, I think it's a challenging thing to choose the path that's right for you. There are two things you can really always change. And we see a lot of this in radiology. People come in from other fields. And then there's one presentation we had in med school that I always love, which was an entrepreneur. He was a physician and he sort of like threw up this menu to the class and was like, you know, everyone's telling you, you can be a physician and go into private practice or work in academia, but I'm here to tell you that there's 100 different things you can do. Mm-hmm. And you should open your mind to that possibility, that if you want to take your experience and work in a totally different way, or if you want to create something, like, that is open to you, but very few people talk about that. So hopefully that can be a good, useful piece of advice for your listeners.
Yeah. That whole locking down the 20, it's like, what do I want to do when I grow up? It's like not a very easy question.
It's a very,
at every progression, like you're saying, I totally get that. It's like, and you got to commit to, I imagine like the whole undergraduate to medical school tradition, which a lot of people just go straight through. That is a huge deal. Cause you're like, as soon as you get the first student loan check, you almost feel like you're kind of locked down.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. To answer your question now. So, so I start working in practice. I am working from home, but things are definitely different at this point. So now we've got two children. I think my eldest is 3 years old at the time. So we've got two under three, a baby on the way. We've moved up to New England, but I have signed on to a teleradiology job, which is what I wanted, but the schedule is actually quite brutal. And I didn't realize it until I was actually in it. So I forget the totals. I mean, I'm working 240 days a year by contract, and about 40% of that are in off hour shifts. And those are week long shifts. So I'm like flipping to nights, and then I'm flipping to like evenings to early morning. So full nights being midnight to 9 a.m. my time, and then evenings being like 6 p.m. or 5 p.m. I think, to like 1 or 2 in the morning. So just about once a month, I'm flipping my sleep schedule completely and getting maybe like a day or two break and going back into work. And oftentimes what I'm doing is I'm working like a five day stretch over, you know, Monday to Friday. And then I immediately go on to the evening or the night block, which is a 7 day block. So I'm working, you know, 12 days straight. And those final, you know, 7 days are exhausting because I'm, you know, my sleep schedule's flipped. We've got young kids. I'm not sleeping very well. Yeah. So the calculus has changed quite a bit at this time, because my wife, who's also a physician, is now sort of, you know, burdened with taking care of two children and a baby. And I'm missing every single dinner every night, despite being home, because a lot of cases I'm doing are stroke cases. So I'm kind of tied to my computer, despite actually, you know, working at home. You know, my kids can't really come in and interrupt me, et cetera. So just the quality of life impact started to really drain on me. And I'm thinking, like, you know, this was initially a really good state of affairs, but now I'm not really so sure, because there's a lot of burden shifted onto my wife. I'm missing a lot of family time. I'm kind of just like drained all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was the primary driver. It was like, you know, I want to be a radiologist. I love what I do. I'm not necessarily anchored to doing 100% neuro. Like some people love their subspecialty and they don't want to touch anything general. And I understand that. I'm willing to be more flexible in that regard. I started thinking, you know, how can I claw back some of that quality of life? Like, there's kind of an idealized dream here where I'm working from home, but I'm missing out on all the core pieces, you know. Yeah. I'm rushing my kids to daycare and rushing back home to get that first stroke case that's coming. And it's like, this doesn't seem right. It's not the vision we had planned. I would say about maybe 8 months into that job, I started thinking, you know, there's probably a better way, and I'm going to start figuring out what that is and planning for it.
What did that look like?
So it's part of this was informed by people within the practice and my schedule. So I'd say the first thing was, like, I thought, well, these evening nights are going to be probably the easiest. They're actually a little bit shorter than the normal shift, but it turns out those were actually brutal. Because I was working from, like, you know, 5 p.m. to like 1, 2 in the morning. We've got little kids waking me up and I'm like sleeping piecemeal for a week, and I was just exhausted. The daytime shift was fine, except I was kind of working past dinner. And actually what we learned is, like, the overnight shifts, if just shifted a little bit, would actually be ideal. My practice at the time had an internal, like, overnight crew, maybe like 15 rads or something, who were very productive. They read a lot of emergency medicine, which I really like and gravitate to. And they worked in a 2 week on, 2 week off schedule. So I'm like, well, these people have significantly more downtime than I do. And coincidentally are making a lot more than I am as well, doing about the same amount of work.
So they're like working as an independent contractor for the practice you had started at?
Well, the contracts were different for overnight workers. So I was in a static salaried position, and I had some benefits where I could earn. The people working overnight were full productivity. One thing that's important here is, like, I've always loved efficiency in my work, and I try to tailor everything I do so that I'm, like, minimizing busy work and automating what I can to make my life easier. So mm-hmm. I generally, like, am on the order of a high producer. So, you know, I'm starting to do the calculations here where I'm like, okay, if I'm getting paid per work unit here, I am actually, you know, I would be making significantly more than what I am now. And at the rate I'm working, naturally, I'm kind of devaluing myself by quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So some of the basic math was like, well, how much am I actually working for per hour? You know, like, here's my contract salary. Here's the total number of days I work. This is the approximate hours. And it was like 9.5 hours a day, 240 days a year. Mm. You know, you divide that from the salary, and it was like, well, that's actually a lot less than I thought, than I right. was hoping to, you know? So some of the basic math is, like, it is pretty striking once you actually, like, set it out in a spreadsheet and think about it. So
yeah, that's a good point. That's a, like, I think everybody should, well, maybe not should, but, like, it might be a good idea for those that aren't aware of what their per hour rate is, even if you're on salary, because it's so easy to, like, not pay attention to that. But if you're on salary, I still think, and maybe it's even more reason to pay attention to, like, it's just doing the math. You would have to track your time to some extent, but doing the math on, like, what that translates to per hour, obviously it's substantially different if you're working 120 hours a week versus, like, 20 hours a week. Huge differences can come in to play. And that's kind of, like, one of the key KPIs or whatever. To total compensation is important, but, like, compensation per hour is even more important.
Yeah. And when they diverge so dramatically, then it's, you know, the total compensation would include benefits, of course, and those sorts of things that might actually not be that much.
Right.
You know, and that's sort of what I learned as well. You know, if I am working for half the amount of value that I can generate, then I can easily pay for my benefits. No problem.
Yeah.
And have quite a bit left over. So yeah, I gave a talk to some residents a couple months back and I encouraged them to do the same thing. I mean, when you get an offer, look, slice it up, you know, do some basic math and see like, what are you making per hour?
Mm-hmm.
And what are you expected to do in that hour? You know, like what sort of pressures will you be under? What's the technology you're working with? Like, 1 hour of time at one practice might be much easier than another practice. This is very true in radiology, depending on the technology stack. So in the radiology world, there's this new thing called an auto impression generator. So if you don't have that versus when you do have that, you might be repeating yourself a lot more. So that's a big factor. It's like, you know, is it easier to produce the same amount of work? That has to be taken into consideration. So yeah, I mean, even if the numbers are estimated, at least it can provide you a baseline of what am I actually earning, mm-hmm. and does it fit with what I think I'm worth? And then you can take that a step further and go out onto job boards and see like, well, what is the current market rate for my work?
Yeah. So you started, it sounds like it was a combination of factors. You were already aware of this whole, I guess the first thing would have been like the values action discrepancy in that you're working these shifts that seemed like they might be okay on the surface, but in reality, they were causing major conflicts with values and interfering. Yeah. And it was just doesn't sound like the timing was good at all. Plus maybe total hours was considerably more than you expected. And then on top of that, you started to realize the kind of like the financial, the numerical KPI type stuff of like dollar per hour, not near as good as what you thought. And
exactly.
And that, I imagine, did that set you down the path of like looking at all the different options out there and exploring and maybe looking at this night shift thing in your own practice and doing the numbers on that? And
yeah, absolutely.
Light bulbs so that start going off.
That was the first thing. I think we realized like, you know, the impact on the family is too great. Something's got to change.
Were you going to change when you figured that part out the other way?
I think so. Yeah.
That's important because like, mm-hmm. I think that is very, I think that's an admirable or not even an admirable. That's a good standard to use is when you realize that you're not doing things that line up with your values. You have to change as quickly as possible. Even if the numbers, it was easier for you because the numbers also confirmed all that. But like, even if the numbers don't confirm that, there's a problem there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we would have changed no matter what, I think. Like,
yeah.
Early on, we were just like, this is not the family life that I had envisioned. And one of the main components of that is the pressure it put on my wife, who's also, you know, a very accomplished, sophisticated physician and deserves to focus on her career if she wants and not be burdened with three children all the time while I'm stuck in an office. So we were going to make the change and had initiated discussions with the practice to say, you know, maybe we should consider about switching to one of these night gigs or evening work or something like that. But it honestly didn't take me long to sort of look out into the marketplace and say, well, actually the if I think about how much, you know, I typically do produce and what the market rate is for that, then it's probably just better to look elsewhere. So yeah, within a couple of days of searching online and looking at, you know, job boards, it was like pretty clear that it would be a hard sell to keep me to stay. And from a non-financial part as well, so all this is happening at the same time, like I had my foot in each part of this practice. You know, there's full day workers, there's full evening workers, there's full night workers, and I'm actually spanning all of them. So I get to talk to all the people who are there. Like, what is your life like when you're just working full evenings every week? Like, you're missing, you know, you're working 1 week on, 1 week off. Is it tiring? Do you get enough rest? Do you spend time with your family? Like, what's the burden on your significant other? And through those conversations, I met somebody who was doing 1 week on and 2 weeks off overnight work, which is a pretty common, I think, in radiology. And he was like, you know, I'd started this out of residency. I've got four kids and I absolutely love it. I'm there for them all the time. And, you know, it's always a challenge having to go back on, but like, you know, the time off is just pure gold. So that also, you know, aligned a lot with our ideas of making a better family life and searching for a practice environment that suited me.
Let's take a quick break to talk about our firm, Renda Financial Planning. The goal of our podcast is to empower you to make better financial decisions. But sometimes the best financial decision you can make is to work with someone who understands your financial goals and has the expertise to keep you on track to reach them. That's where Ren Financial Planning comes in. We are a full-service financial planning firm that works with over 400 physicians and their families across the country. We charge a transparent monthly flat fee for our services and offer virtual meetings you can take from anywhere. Best of all, you'll get to work with a team that specializes in working with physician families. So whether you're starting out and wondering how you'll balance your student loan payments and saving for a home, or you are an established physician trying to figure out how to pay for your kids' college and how much you need to save to reach financial freedom, we can help. I'll put a link in the show notes to schedule a no-obligation meeting with one of our certified financial planners. Ren Financial Planning, LLC is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit renfinancial.com. That's WRENNEfinancial.com.
Was there a lot of value benefits associated with this whole like employed status that you, I think not just benefits like on financial side, but I'm talking about like
sure.
support staff or like protection or insurance and, or like culture or, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So the practice I signed on with is a large private practice. It's also physician owned. And that was very important to me because like many fields of medicine, there is an insinuation of private equity. So I didn't quite vibe with that and wanted to be in a physician owned practice. Mm. The role I initially took on is also was a partnership track. So my goal was to be a partner. And that does come with, of course, you know, financial and non-financial rights. So you get the quarterly and then end of year partner bonus. And then you also have, you know, voting rights and other things. The practice itself was quite large. And so that allowed me to specialize more, which was also desirable right out of fellowship. And then they're also like, they have a very big footprint and are well known to be a strong practice. So there's stability there, which is also key. In practice, what I realized is that like, you know, I do have a slightly elevated risk tolerance, and the stability itself was not necessarily, you know, that important to me when I'm taking essentially a financial hit based on my capabilities. So again, like looking at the numbers can really drive a decision, like how much, you know, I'm working for this much an hour, how much do the partners earn? Okay, so they're getting a nice lofty bonus. But what's the tax? What are the tax implications of all of those things? And what do you have afterwards? And so there are a lot of factors to dig into. But once you start looking at them and parsing it out, I think the decision can kind of reveal itself at that time. And at least it did for me. So, yeah, I mean, it's just an interesting study in what I thought I wanted, and then kind of pivoting very quickly when I realized the reality of what I thought I wanted was actually quite different, especially when it looked with family life.
Right. I think one of the gaps or issues I've seen sometimes in medical practices is that there's not as high of a focus on like the team's values, I guess you could say, like the people involved and their values. And so I think there's some good opportunity for like small or any size practice, I guess, but seems like something small, like adjusting how shifts work or like getting feedback from your people regularly, or like having really good communication and being tight with your people where they drive the culture. Like that stuff doesn't seem to happen very often. And I think that's another potential solution to help move the needle on, especially physician owned practices. Now, private equity is a different beast because you start to get different influencing factors. I wish there were more practices that really like, so if I was involved in that practice as a partner that you were working for, and I knew you were working there, I would want to know what challenges you were having and try to make adjustments to cater to the career path you wanted, because we, you know, value you as a solid resource. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a way of viewing it. But at the end of the day, you have to do what's best for your family. And if it's not a fit, and on top of that, it's more lucrative to leave. That's like a home run.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. It was truly hard to justify staying once I sort of realized what was out there, if I was willing to take a little bit of risk.
What was the risk like? I mean, besides, so leaving the stuff you just described,
mm-hmm.
that's one. The risk that nobody pays you any money. I mean, what are the risks?
Yeah. So the risks are, of course, like leaving stability. You could have variable income. That's one factor. There's timing related risks where, you know, it may take, you know, 6 months or more.
Who's to get paying you? Is it the hospitals, or who are you contracted with?
So I can go into that, but
okay.
There's timing related. There's a lot of like little factors that could add up. There's always like insurance related things,
like practice insurance.
Yep. Then there's business insurance, cyber insurance. I mean, there's a, you know, if you strike on your own, there's sort
technology. You have to get your own technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I decided to do was basically form an entity for myself to operate under, and then contract to practices in this like kind of window of time. So I landed on working overnights from 10 p.m. to 7 p.m. or 7 a.m. Eastern time, and like searching for gigs that would support that. So only 1099, you know, I'm looking for basically like, what is your technology stack? How, you know, what is it like reading for you? What sort of case mix are we talking about? Mostly it was general, but you know, at this rate, now I'm, you know, planning and realizing, you know, I just from a dollar per work unit, I might be making, you know, double what I was doing, the same work, you know, reading the same, you know, neuro study with CTA head and neck for stroke. And so, or like a body CT, you know, the case, the dollar per case might be literally double what I was looking at. So there was a bit of a need, which I think I tapped into, and there's a bit of like savvy that I think I was lucky to kind of have, where I could realize that, you know, these practices need this slot filled. Mm-hmm. There's a premium pay for overnight, and there's quite a bit of need. So I had a lot to choose from at that rate.
So there was definitely risk. I mean, I think anytime you're making a big change, there's risk of,
right,
I guess, even if it's obvious, just not working out as you expected.
Yeah.
I mean,
just for timing risk, you know, I have like a pretty large credentialing packet, right? So I've worked in teleradiology for only 3 years, but now I have multiple state license. I've got tons of hospitals I'm credentialed at. So from initiation of my business and the contracts with the practice to actually getting credentialed at all their sites, like it took longer than expected, and I lost out on a couple shifts and lost a fair amount of money actually at that time. And so one thing I was, you know, we had to talk to my wife is like, well, you know, we lost maybe, you know, a large portion of income at this time, and we've got to make sure that we have the cash to fund our life as we're transitioning here. So there's some situations you can find yourself in that are a little bit scary, but
yeah,
those are the risks essentially.
Was it scary at any point?
I think I had a good vision for how it would work, but there was a bit of time where I'm like, I'm not getting credentialed, or it's taking longer. And
in like, you know, the last stretch, in the home stretch.
Yeah, kind of like before things are starting up, and I'm starting to get a little nervous, like, you know. And then, you know, of course things are paid in arrears, so you've got like, you know, you got, might have a month or two, month and a half delay from when you actually did the work. And so before I know it, I'm like, oh my gosh, am I going to be able to fund my salary, you know, our life? And luckily that did come to fruition. But yeah, you've got to be able to manage that sort of thing, and maybe have a little bit of money in the bank in case, and plan for it financially, if, you know, if, because I think one of the adages was like every plan for things to, you know, cost double and take triple the amount of time so that you can adjust when needed.
And then you get pleasantly surprised instead of disappointed. I mean, yeah, the perfectionist terrible. Mentality ruined will mess you up in entrepreneurship. You know, the perfectionist yeah. will say, let's get the perfect timeline and the perfect budget. And then they go do it. And they're like, over time and over budget by 20% or something, they're super frustrated, even though it's probably pretty efficient. Whereas it's probably better to be like, double, triple the budget, double, triple the time. And then you can be under and be like, wow, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But to answer your question, if it was scary, I mean, you know, leaving a big practice to strike out on your own is kind of is a pretty big jump, you know, and I kind of went from like having an IT department to help me work through, set up all my equipment and everything to like kind of putting it up on my own and, you know, making sure I have the power to even run the stuff where I need to run it and connecting in and actually like, you know, reading the studies, which is like when you have a team of IT professionals, they can just get you through it. But it is a little scary, like when you're doing it all yourself and, you know, you run into little snags here and there. And so, yeah, that transition was a little bit scary, but you know, we made it through and it's been fruitful.
It's a little bit overwhelming wearing all the hats and
yeah,
there's nobody to, it all comes to you. They're like, if there's a problem, it's like, I guess it's my problem I got to solve. And it's a little different than a working for a practice with multiple people and that sort of thing. But you know, you can, in some ways, I've heard a lot of people say they're stressed out in their practices. And when I understand what they're stressed out about, a lot of times it's these things that I think the problem is it's these things that they can't change. It's like these forced either red tape or mechanisms or practice standards or whatever that are causing the stress. So I kind of look at it like two different flavors of stress. There's stress you have no control over, which is like 10 times more detrimental. And then there's the stress you have control over and you can solve the problems to make it go down or go away. And I think entrepreneurship is more in that camp of being able, because you can be like, oh, well, I guess I can change things and I don't have to go through all the red tape. And
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's the trade-off that you make too, is like you have a lot more control and, you know, if a contract isn't working out for you, you can go and search for another one, but that's also up to you. So, you have to be in the driver's seat there, and each transition you make might have its own, you know, benefits and risks that have to be assessed. And so it's a transition from going to work, sitting at your desk, if you're a radiologist or seeing your patients, to then thinking like more on the administrative side of like, well, how am I going to get paid? You know, have I talked to my CPA recently, and you know, do I need an attorney, and how do I stand up this entity and make sure that it has all the protections it needs and can, you know, satisfy its responsibilities to the state and to the IRS and whomever else. So, it's an empowering scenario if it's right for you, of course, but it has its risks that come along with it.
Yeah. Solely on your own either. Like you're like the quarterback, I guess, but you have a team of people. You already mentioned like an accountant. I don't know if you still work with a life coach. That's, you know, but you got a spouse, I know you work with a financial planner, those kinds of people and consultants, and you can hire those kinds of things.
Right.
And they're very valuable, especially when you start talking about entrepreneurship, because there's just so many things.
Yeah. So good tip for anyone who's listening and thinking about this. Early on, I learned about the small business development centers, which are usually in each state, federally funded, and provide you with free resources. So when I was initially thinking, you know, I'm probably going to do this, I reached out to them right away and got connected with an advisor, and he was instrumental in getting me through the first month or so of like, what am I actually doing? You know, I've got to register a business entity. Well, what type of business entity, and what is an S corporation or an LLC, electing S corporation status federally, and all these things I had no idea about. They connected me to a CPA initially who was just free of charge. And she gave me some incredible advice and helped me get everything up and running. So they've been key. I mean, I think I got attorneys that I use who have been great. And now I have an accounting firm that does my work. And, you know, that team has come together and they're not on my payroll, but they certainly help round out all the things that I don't understand or know about and can make it work. But you can utilize that free resource. It's there for anybody. It's extremely powerful. You know, if you're going to go this route, you know, expect it to take 6 months to get through it, especially if you're working your full-time job right now and making the change. I mean, you might be just doing some paperwork off hours and that's just what it takes, and it's scary at first. But once you get through that, like you just build a new knowledge base and then it becomes kind of second nature. You know, it's now I think about, you know, tax implications of what I'm doing all the time, where last year around this time, I had no idea what a lot of that meant for me at the time. So
yeah, it's a good and then, healthy exercise to go through. I think entrepreneurship is very healthy. It's a little bit, it's more holistic. It's like it forces you to get into more areas than just like the grind. You kind of have to look at the whole holistic aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. And if like, you know, there's a lot of different ways to go about your career, but I know some people will maybe, you know, drop down to, you know, 0.75 or even 0.5 FTE and then utilize that free time to go into a hobby and maybe build a small business related to that. And that can be very, very successful and fulfilling in its own right. So that's, you know, it's really no different from what I'm doing from a practice standpoint. You just would still use the same resources and, you know, hopefully it would be an enjoyable experience. But I do agree. I think it's been incredibly empowering to have gone through this process and, you know, to still be alive.
This time. You're probably healthier than ever. Definitely sounds like getting more sleep and more family time and financially beneficial. Yeah. Those are all good things. So like I'm thinking about the state of medicine and there's a lot of like burnout or career frustration, or maybe if I'm listening, I'm not even in practice and I'm like in training and I'm like a little bit overwhelmed by that, the prospects of that, because you kind of hear about that and you see it and you get taste of it and you're like, oh my goodness, how am I gonna avoid that? But what you've done a good job like navigating that really well, or at least from my observation. I'd like to hear kind of your take on this too, but like from my perspective, it looks like you've been able to navigate like life hurdles, dissatisfaction, burnout, whatever you want to call it, very well, and allow the profession to complement your life instead of like interfere with your life. It seems like you've done a really good job with that, which I think is super important. But the part that I really like especially is I know a lot of people that have done pretty good with that, but they, in order to do that, they had to leave medicine completely.
Right.
Which I get frustrated when I see that for several reasons. I can't really blame them, but like, it's especially encouraging when I talk to people that have figured out kind of a way to navigate that while also still staying in the group. Yeah. So I'm curious, so your take, is that an accurate assessment? Like, do you feel good about that on your end? And then maybe advice you would have for others that are struggling with that?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, if I had to summarize what I understand about that problem, it's that the people who leave medicine don't do it because of medicine. You know, they love the job. They love being physicians. If you're a surgeon, you love to be a surgeon. It's all the other stuff that gets in the way of that. You know, the charting burden, things like that. Administrative burden, if you're calling insurances, you know, and dealing with insurance and payers and, you know, certain aspects of the career that are not well suited to clinical practice and are there to sort of, you know, they're there for a reason, but they're not efficient and they drag you down and they're sometimes even downright painful to go through. Yeah. I mean, my heart goes out to those people. And I do think maybe there are some solutions coming down the pipeline. For example, like the AI note-taking technology that's coming can dramatically changed the experience for my wife's a psychiatrist, and she uses that now almost exclusively and says, you know, I have a conversation with a person now. I'm not typing the entire time. And then when I finalize the patient encounter, I look at the notes and I just edit what I need to and move on. So that note-taking burden has dropped significantly. I mean, that's not the only thing. I know there's multifactorial, but in radiology in particular, I do see some older physicians who have never really learned the technology that we work with. There are sometimes ways to make your life easier, but there's really nobody to teach you. You know, it's like you get an introduction to the technology you use like the first day of your training and then never again. And, you know, I would encourage those people who are maybe really frustrated with the systems that they have to try to spend some time and dig deeper. Ask questions like, can I automate this process? Is this a task that I could delegate if that's possible? Or any of these little burdens that you might come up against, like, you know, I've got to click the chart like 5 times to do this thing. Like, you know, there are scripting languages you can do to automate mouse movements and keystrokes and stuff like that. So, you know, that might just be like a fun technical thing for people inclined to that to try to dig into.
Yeah.
And now in particular is a really good time because you can just fire up ChatGPT or, you know, Claude and say, you know, this is my work and I am really frustrated by these 10 things. Like, create me a plan to try to address some of them and, reduce the
burden. It's surprisingly good. I mean, it surprises me regularly. I'm like, that's pretty good. Some of the answers that it comes up with, and something about problem solving, like, really, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a problem solver, but I think everybody is to some extent, and something about solving the problem that's slowing you down or causing stress or frustration in your life. Like, that's really, even if it's like an incremental solve, like, that's a really rewarding thing. And it can be incredibly stressful in an environment where you're unable to solve the problem.
Yeah. That's kind of the beauty of the language models, is that you can utilize that to unblock, you know, or challenge some of the thinking that you have and do it in a way that, you know, only takes a little bit of time. It doesn't cost anything. You don't have to act upon it in any way. So you can say, like, you know, these are the assumptions I work under, challenge them. And if we were to address one of them, what's the highest impact, or help me understand which would be the highest impact and how I could go about it. And so you can kind of explore these dark caverns in ways that, like, wouldn't really be possible before under normal circumstances. At least that's how I feel. Like, it's kind of like spelunking with a headlamp instead of like kind of doing it in the dark and like feeling my way through, in a way that, like, I'm unblocked quite frequently by some, you know, by problems that I would take me much longer to solve. So there might be things that are really challenging. Like, I know insistence by certain organizations that, like, you know, primary care physicians see shorter and shorter patient encounters to have more and more patients on the schedule. I mean, that's really tough. Mm-hmm. ChatGPT cannot solve that problem, but there might be a creative solution. And early in my career, I spoke to, this is back in medical school, I spoke to a primary care doctor who elected to do some concierge medicine. It was interesting in the fact that it was not what I had anticipated it would be like. It was still, you know, a pretty high patient load. You know, it wasn't just like working for one family, you know, or two very wealthy families. Yeah. So they actually had numerous patients and had made that work where they found work-life balance,
right?
in a way that wasn't really possible.
Right. I think ChatGPT ChatGPT is an example of like an AI technology. You go in there and you ask it, you're like, I'm really stressed out about my primary care job. The problem is that I have to see so many patients and I don't have enough time and the burdens with the insurance. And ChatGPT might just say, why don't you just leave it and charge patients per month at a rate that translates to the number of patients you want to have? And that's essentially what concierge medicine is. It's just like, how many patients do I want to have? In other words, how concierge do I want it to be? And then let's back into how much we charge per month to make the finances work. And then you're off to the races. Old school. It's really more like, it's not even concierge. It's really like how it used to be way back in the day.
Yeah. Like cash fee for service. And Then there is a problem with that. The fundamental problem is, of course, that there, you know, we live in a society where many people cannot pay. And so you leave people out and diminish access to care. So,
but that there's always problems. So you have to make sure you're not letting the problems paralyze you.
Yeah.
And instead, moving forward with solving the problems you can solve.
Right.
That's one thing I've noticed, especially in primary care. It's like, well, there's all these 25 problems and there's no point. Like, I'm just going to throw in the towel and bury my head. And that's the worst thing you can do. You got to be like, okay, well, which of these 25 problems can I solve? Let's focus on that one.
And those are big systems problems. Like, you know, no single physician can, change the state of economics and aging in our society. And so, you do have to do what's best for you. Of course, there are a lot of wonderful people out there who care very deeply about serving, the poor or the frail. And I think that that's a beautiful thing, but you cannot solve those problems by yourself. And if it's driving you to the brink, then it's certainly worth exploring a change, and then of course, there's lots of ways to advocate around that as well. But I certainly feel for my primary care colleagues who are sort of, I feel like squeezed very, very often and kind of under this continuous type of cycle where, they're being forced to just do more and more with less. So that's a tough situation.
Yeah, no. And I think the biggest thing I would encourage for everyone, which Brad's got a really good handle on, is just always making sure you're clear on what's most important. Like you were at the very beginning, you're talking about chasing the things. When you're not clear on what's most important in your life, you always gravitate towards chasing the things that the culture tells you to chase, which always lead to unhappiness. And so you have to be intentional with taking the time to iron out or remind yourself of what's most important in your world. And then hang on to that because there's so much pressure to go the other way.
Right. Right. Yeah.
It's everywhere. You were talking about with the finance industry. I can verify all that. It's money, more money, more money, more money, money. I mean, that's just one of the big influences. It's you can be a billionaire, you can be a whatever. And
yeah, exactly.
Solve all your problems.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my colleagues went into medicine because they wanted to do something that's really valuable and your skills are incredibly valuable. And I think that actually is very important at the dawn of AI when I use it all the time and still realize that last final judgment piece is very much lacking. So the human component is incredible. And I hope it is not replaced. And I think that there's still a role for all sorts of the physician specialties out there. And hopefully, the technology can come and make our lives easier in a way that it can bring the joy back into medical care. So that's my hope for the future. And, if that's not something that you're experiencing and you're really unhappy in your current role, I would just encourage you to look out elsewhere and see what else is available. Cause there may be, I don't want to say the grass is always greener, of course, but we live in a unique time and there may be opportunities that suit your life better. And if you're unhappy, that just really doesn't help anybody. It doesn't matter, how many people you may be saving how much money you're making. If you are really unhappy in your life, I do think it's important to explore a change. And for us, it was family time. And, I don't want to miss, dinner every night with my children. I mean, that's non-negotiable.
Yeah, I completely agree, Brad. Well, this has been fun. I've enjoyed talking. I would love to keep going. I feel like we could go on for a few hours. I can sense a little entrepreneurial spirit in you, which I love. We didn't get to talk too much about it, but I could definitely get into the weeds with that. But I really appreciate you coming on and talking through your experience.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, we can do this again another time. It was my pleasure.
Definitely.
No guests or clients appearing on the podcast received any form of compensation for their appearance and obtained no other benefit from us. It should not be assumed that every client has had the same experience.